This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to discuss the art of government propaganda. To help us understand it, we're very pleased to have as our special guest Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communications at New York University. Professor Miller is the author of numerous books, including Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. He wrote the introduction to the recently republished classic Propaganda by Edward Bernays and is featured in the documentary films Stealing America, Vote by Vote, about the 2004 presidential election, and Orwell Rolls in His Grave, about corporate control of media. Professor Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with a quote from MIT professor Noam Chomsky, and I'd like your comments on it. He wrote in Media Control, "Propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state." What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, the fact is that totalitarian states also use propaganda. They rely on it, even though they have a complete monopoly on violence. But it is true that the propaganda is the main means whereby the state, in an ostensible democracy, has its way with the people. You know, this has really been the case for the last 100 years or so, or at least, you know, most notably since World War I. You've got to master public opinion in order to do what you want to do, and the way to do that is to use propaganda.
What are the most important propagandists of the last century? Joseph Goebbels said, in propaganda, truth should be used as frequently as possible.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, Joseph Goebbels was, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda. And he, although he didn't write a single, you know, comprehensive treatment of the subject, his diaries and memos and so forth comprise a remarkably astute kind of how-to for any aspiring propagandist. He's the example that most often comes to mind when we talk about state propaganda at its most sinister and lurid. But he had his counterpart, he has had various counterparts, in the West. Even though American propaganda hasn't been as spectacular as Nazi propaganda, I think you could easily argue that the American government has relied as extensively on propaganda, especially over the last 10 years or so, has relied as extensively on propaganda as the Nazis did. Goebbels said a lot of quite brilliant things about propaganda. He noticed, for example, that the most effective propaganda is the kind that calls the least attention to itself. In other words, when you know you're being approached by a propagandist, when you know you're being addressed by someone with an ulterior motive, you're on your guard. Whereas if the propaganda seems almost as it were part of a natural environment, it's like the very air we breathe, and we don't quite notice it, we don't focus on it, it's all the more effective for that, because our guard is down. You know, now Goebbels would, you know, point to various kinds of film, public spectacle, torchlight parades, things like that. But we have, in the commercial sphere, product placement and stealth marketing and all sorts of other covert methods that, in their own way, are just as just as cynical and just as effective as the stuff the Nazis came up with.
And while you try to stick to the truth as a propagandist, you can certainly influence people by the selective use of the truth. For example, in 1860, you're representing Abraham Lincoln, and you mentioned that he's born in a log cabin, but you don't mention the fact that at the time he's a wealthy railroad lawyer.
Well, of course, of course. I mean, Goebbels was right about the use of the truth. Whenever possible, propaganda must be factually accurate. The wilder and more fanciful it becomes, the more it relies on outright fabrications.
Now Hitler did mention that he said the great masses of the people will more easily fall victims to a big lie than to a small lie. Why is that?
Well, that's a very famous theory of the big lie, is based on the assumption that people, you know, will be less inclined to doubt or resist an enormous lie precisely because it's hard to believe that anyone would tell a lie that big, you see. And I think that's a perception that's extremely pertinent to the moment we're living at now, because I believe that this regime, the one that has seized power here, Bush-Cheney, has lied in precisely that way on every front. I believe that their ostensible electoral victories from 2000 on have all been bogus. I don't believe they were ever elected.
And yet the big lie has succeeded.
Oh, well, it has, because I found, you know, in writing about this particular issue, that the Democrats and the media, including many left liberal outlets, by the way, have been remarkably reluctant to even to discuss the issue, because I think deep down it's too big, it's too frightening. The implications are too radical and shattering. And so, you know, there's a good example of a big lie
that was carried off.
Yeah.
Now, when we talk about propaganda in America, one of the intellectuals we have to talk about is Walter Lippmann, who wrote the book Public Opinion, published in 1922.
Right.
And he coined a term, the manufacture of consent.
Right.
What was Lippmann's thesis?
Well, Lippmann's view was, you know, he was a progressive of sorts. That had a very different meaning back then from what it means today. But he, you know, he believed that the government can and should do good things, not only domestically but worldwide. But his view of the public was so, he had such a dark view of public reason that he believed that it was essential for the survival of democracy that there be a kind of caste of experts who were above politics and who would have the wisdom and the skill to basically, I mean, to be blunt about it, to keep the people fooled, to direct the public, direct public opinion in beneficial ways, manufacture consent, in short.
And who would the experts be working for?
Well, I suppose they would represent a business and the state. They would basically be at the service of the elites.
So
no question about that.
In the context, say, of a medieval society, it might have been the leaders of the church. Today, it would be the leaders of multinational corporations and their corporate allies.
Yes.
The government allies.
Yes. I mean, but you don't have a dynamic public with effective and ever-changing opinions in the Middle Ages. You have three estates. It's fairly static. And you have all three estates, that is the nobility, the peasantry, and the clergy, all basically convinced of the truth of Christianity and persuaded of the truth of a kind of Christian notion of government.
So modern democracy brings in a new dynamic, a
yes.
new need to manage public opinion.
That's right. This first became quite clear with the successful enterprise of the First World War. I mean, when we talk about propaganda, as we have been doing today, we tend to go immediately to the sort of grotesque and magnetic example of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. I mean, they're always uppermost in our minds because, in a certain sense, you know, their propaganda achievement was so successful. They managed to sort of portray themselves as so much glamour of a dark kind that we always think first about them. But the fact is that modern propaganda, whether it's commercial or political, had its roots not in you know, fascist Europe, but in England and America in the 19th century. Modern propaganda and advertising is simply a sphere of propaganda, were both basically Anglo-American creations, the late 19th century.
One of the terms that that Walter Lippmann uses in his book, Public Opinion, is transference. It's a technical term that relates to how propaganda is created. Can you explain that term?
Transference, you mean in the psychoanalytic
sense? Yeah, in the sense of you have a stimulus, produces an emotion, and then the trick is to transfer this to other objects?
Well, yeah, let's be clear that the rise of this new science of propaganda, if we want to call it a science, was coincided with a new interest in psychology, applied psychology, for political effect, and one of the things that Lippmann understood the propagandist must do is to find the ways in which one might move people at an irrational level. Lippmann understood very, very keenly that the collective mind, the mind of the mob, if you want to call it that, is not a reasoning mind. It's not logical. That people en masse tend to be irrational. Now, I think that Lippmann takes this further than necessary. I think that his distrust of democracy is ultimately quite dangerous. But he makes a very compelling case in Public Opinion.
As I understand it, the idea is to create have a stimulus which creates a strong emotion in the viewer, and then associate that with something, and then gradually replace that something with something else.
Yeah, well, yes, and you know, to enunciate the theory in that way makes it sound maybe a little more cut and dry than it was in practice.
But yes.
Basically, let's return to the example of the First World War.
Right.
Here we had a conflict of unprecedented violence that had to be sold to populations that had no particular reason to want to go to war at all. You know, the Americans and the British were really disinclined to get involved in another war. How does one basically sell a conflict like this to people when, you know, the interests being served, in fact, are not the interests of the public? You know, it was basically an obscure imperialist rivalry.
So that's when the Creel Commission comes in.
That's right. The Creel Commission, this is, you know, formed, well, when we're talking about the United States.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson appointed George Creel to be the head of the Committee on Public Information, which basically had the job of selling the war to the average American. And the obverse of this, of course, the necessary obverse of all propaganda is censorship. So the committee's job was twofold. It was, first of all, to sanitize the war and make sure that its true horror didn't register, you know, at home. And also to come up with a number of very stirring, purely emotional stimuli that would get people, you know, on board. What they did was they represented the Germans as Huns. You know, they sort of rehabilitated this old Asiatic threat and very cleverly identified the Germans with the Huns of yesteryear, and represented the whole conflict as a battle between barbarism and civilization.
And an argument like that, of course, you can't win, because if you're opposed to the war, then you're on the side of evil.
That's right. And that's why the war was, you know, politically and culturally such a catastrophe. It shattered the socialist movement at the time, because a lot of people on the left were swept away by this notion that, you know, we simply had to fight the Germans because they were worse than animals. They were simply, you know, brutal, sadistic monsters like the barbarians of old. Now, the British were the most prolific in coming up with atrocity stories that actually bore no relation to reality whatsoever.
These were the big lies?
Well, they were a lot of big lies. I mean, you know, they weren't quite big lies, because the Prussians were indeed quite brutal, but they didn't do any of the things they were accused of doing.
Yes.
They didn't crucify Allied soldiers. They didn't cut the breasts off of nurses and bat them back and forth with their butts of their rifles. They didn't impale babies on bayonets. These are the kinds of stories that were concocted by the British on the basis of first-hand reports, but there was a tremendous amount of, you know, fancy and invention in these stories. And it's worth noting that the particular commission that came up with these stories had on it a number of very famous fiction writers and poets, you know, people like Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, this is the guy, you know, his Sherlock Holmes stories are beloved the world over. This guy really knows how to tell a story. People like him and like H.G. Wells and others were working for the government in a kind of literary capacity to invent these atrocity tales that would make the war almost irresistible.
Did they know the stories, the material for the stories weren't true?
I think at the very highest levels they had to know.
Do you think that the writers knew, or were they just filling
the material? Very hard. That's the most interesting question about propaganda across the board, is the extent to which those who engage in it are themselves convinced of it. Chomsky, for one, is absolutely certain that the people who do propaganda know that it's all lies. That's where I differ with. I take issue with that. I think that's too simple. I think that very often people both know and don't know that what they're saying is false. The fact is that in 1918, this is 10 years after the war's conclusion, a very important book came out called Lies in Wartime. It was written by Lord Ponsonby, who was a socialist member of parliament. It was a short but very effective, very meticulous analysis of all the most notorious atrocity tales that had been, you know, used throughout the propaganda drive to get people on board. Ponsonby demonstrates in every case that the story was false, was made up. And this is something a lot of people had suspected. But Ponsonby, you know, he had let enough time go by that people were ready to hear the truth. And the book was an enormous bestseller, both here and in Britain, and it did a tremendous amount to enlighten, some might say, disillusion people about what the truth really was. You know, the reaction after it became clear that the governments of Britain and the U.S. had really basically fooled people on a grand scale, the reaction was quite devastating. An enormous wave of anger and sort of cynicism. So the lesson here is that, and this is where Goebbels' point about using the truth comes into play, you have to be very careful as a propagandist not to lie so egregiously that the lies can then be exposed. Because once the lies are exposed, once people lose faith in a particular set of authorities, once the people see through a particular regime, and that regime loses what we call its credibility, it's finished. There is no way to get it back. Goebbels understood this. I think his understanding was based in large part on what happened after World War One, when retrospectively, you know, people became extremely bitter, and there was an enormous sort of anti-war movement, pacifist movement, that was accelerated by this, just, you know, belated discovery that it was all lies.
Now, the Creel Commission had a lot of help. It was also known as the Committee on Public Information. Creel organized all sorts of aspects of our media to support him, the films, newspapers, publication division. As you mentioned, famous writers would work for him. The advertising industry had a board supporting him. Why do important people seem to be very willing to volunteer for an enterprise like that?
Well, you know, the whole media system jumped in quite enthusiastically to help out with this. I believe that it was people felt that it was their duty. There was a certain euphoria. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we know in our own time that the prospect of a righteous war really sets people on fire.
Walter Lippmann mentions that. He says, the citizen experiences a pleasurable emotion as he supports the foreign adventure.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we've seen it in our own time. People feel, there are few feelings as, I don't know what to say, as overwhelming or as toxic as the feeling of committing oneself to a just national crusade.
And we all seem to enjoy the power, too. We join in it, even though we're not personally at risk.
You have a sense of power. You have a sense of impunity. You have a sense of righteous aggression. You have a sense of utter belonging. I mean, it's a brainless kind of an experience. You're surrendering your own reason to the mob, and it has the sanction of the whole establishment. So, you know, it's quite something.
Creel also used front groups, like he had organizations called Friends of German Democracy and the League of Oppressed Nations. Why is a propagandist find those types of things useful?
Well, it's again, you know, propaganda is that much more compelling when it seems not to be propaganda. If stuff comes directly from the government, it's going to be less impressive than stuff that seems to come from groups of citizens who are either disinterested, that is to say, you know, they've looked at all the evidence and they've come to the inevitable conclusion that they must join the fight, or groups that you know, represent people, I think the emphasis should be on people who have reason to side with the Allies against the Axis powers, the Central powers, I guess they were called. So, you know, using front groups is a way to make the propaganda drive seem to come from everywhere. You know, everybody's on board.
You'd also mention censorship. And Lippmann said on that subject, without some form of censorship, propaganda is impossible. Is it necessary to have that backstop?
Well, yes. See, the thing is, people often mistakenly use the word persuasion as a kind of synonym for propaganda. Propaganda is not persuasion. Persuasion involves argument. Persuasion involves dialogue. You and your adversary sort of hash it out. He or she has his or her counterarguments, and you address them, and you try to bring that person around to your way of thinking. Propaganda doesn't work that subtly, nor can it take that long to work, nor does it involve a partnership of discussants. Propaganda wants to sweep away, it wants to obliterate, but let me put it this way, it wants all other points of view already to have been obliterated.
So it's fundamentally anti-democratic.
It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It's anti-rational. It wants not to persuade you. Rather, it wants to create a universe in which you would never even stop to think that there might be another way of looking at it. Like, take for example, commercial advertising. You know, commercial advertising dominates certain media. TV, for example. Well, it wouldn't be enough for the commercial firms that subsidize TV. From their point of view, it would not be enough for them to let people quibble or argue with the ads by, say, offering some, you know, fairly honest consumer reporting on the real worth of the products being sold. They don't want that. They don't want it there at all. They want the universe of TV to be completely complementary to the advertising message. And this is exactly how state propaganda works. It does not want to engage in argument. It wants to create an entirely hermetic space where there is nothing but itself making its points over and over again. If you're allowed to hear from the other side, it's always the other side as concocted by the propagandists themselves. But no one can really break into this system. It's closed tight as a drum.
One of the most important propagandists to come out of World War I, perhaps the most important, was Edward Bernays. And in his book, Propaganda, originally published in 1928, and you've written the introduction to the recent publication, Bernays wrote, quote, "Those who manipulate the masses constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government." Could you talk about that?
Yeah, Bernays is very, very heavily influenced by Lippmann, but he had far less ambivalence. He had no ambivalence whatsoever about the craft of propaganda, whereas Lippmann was at least mindful of the objections on democratic grounds. Bernays was in the propaganda business himself, whereas Lippmann was a kind of sage. You know, he wrote a very influential newspaper column. He had the ear of the great and the prominent. He was still a journalist of sorts, whereas Bernays called himself the father of public relations, and indeed, he was probably the foremost practitioner of commercial propaganda out there. This isn't just advertising per se. Bernays was a brilliant man who understood that you don't sell things directly, but rather figure out how to manipulate circumstances so that you create desires without specifically trumpeting the virtues of a particular product. Let me give you an example. He was hired by a piano company to help improve the sales of pianos. This is sometime in the 20s. Well, what he did was he actually made a successful effort to popularize the idea of adding music rooms to private homes. You know, he did this by working with people in architectural magazines and so on. Created a fad for music rooms. Well, once you have created that fad and people are eager to build music rooms, it's only natural that piano companies will benefit, and in particular the piano company that had hired Bernays, because, you know, they could then take advantage of that new architectural innovation, standing ready to provide pianos that will fit perfectly in with this new decor.
So he had the patience to come at the problem indirectly and
exactly.
To nurture the demand.
He came at the problem indirectly. And we have to, you know, the book Propaganda is very impressive. One has to understand that it is not just, it is not in any sense a detached analysis of propaganda. It is actually itself a kind of sales brochure for Bernays' own services.
Although he was basically a commercial person, one of the people groups he represented was United Fruit, which got him involved in the 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala against Arbenz.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is where Bernays becomes extremely interesting. We spoke before about the difficulty of figuring out exactly how conscious the propagandist is of the spuriousness of his claims. Is he a self-conscious manipulator, knowingly telling lies, or is he someone who, at some level, actually has persuaded himself that what he's saying is true? Bernays was a highly rational person, formidably rational, you know, cold, really, and an old progressive as well.
He was also the nephew of Sigmund Freud.
He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, did a great deal to popularize Freud's works in this country. But he really did believe that he was doing something morally unexceptionable, that he was not lying, he was not selling anything destructive. To his credit, he had a great deal to do with the marketing of Lucky Strikes for American tobacco in the 30s and the 20s. Later in life, when the toxicity of cigarette smoking was beyond question, he mounted a kind of crusade to get public relations people not to handle tobacco accounts. So he did have a conscience, and he was capable of seeing that certain things were wrong. But if you go back and you look at his autobiography and read his chapter on his involvement with the United Fruit Company in Guatemala, you can see clearly that he was tremendously troubled by the fact that United Fruit and the CIA were simply destroying a democratic government.
So his role would be to help place articles in prominent American media suggesting that the democratically elected head of Guatemala was a communist. Was that sort of the idea?
Yeah. Yes. And he is in this instance, he is a study in self-delusion, because whenever the question arises of whether he was aware of the darker, more anti-democratic aspects of the enterprise, you see him retreat into this position of, I couldn't find any really solid information. I had trouble getting accurate information from Guatemala. I just couldn't find out what was going on. And that what that actually meant was that he didn't want to recognize the truth that was coming from, the ground in Guatemala, so he would dismiss the sources as unreliable.
And at the end of the operation, of course, Arbenz was undermined and forced out of power.
Well, it set democracy in that country back decades and opened the door to a hideous series of bloody dictatorships. It was a major crime against humanity, but he would never have been able to see it that way.
And of course, now in more recent events, and we see the use of many important propaganda techniques in the Persian Gulf War and in the Iraq War. In the 1980s, for example, Saddam Hussein was a strong ally of the United States and was portrayed very sympathetically in our media. And in 1990, he became worse than Hitler. How did George Bush Sr. do that?
Well, this is a good example of how propaganda works. There were a number of inconvenient facts that stood in the way of marshaling broad mass American support for the war, the first Gulf War. One was, actually, Saddam Hussein wasn't particularly well treated by the U.S. media in the 80s. He didn't get much coverage at all. There were attempts by human rights groups to basically, impose sanctions on his regime. There were efforts in Congress to do that because of the gassing of the Kurds at Halabja. I was, obliquely involved in those efforts myself in the 80s.
But they were blocked by the Reagan.
They were blocked
Bush,
by the Reagan administration.
Which Bush administration? Far, yes.
It never actually got to the point of getting much press coverage. The Amnesty International did a harrowing report on human rights abuses in Iraq in the 80s. And I read that, and that's what galvanized me. But basically this all happened, without any media attention. the fact, the crucial fact, as you note, is that our government turned a deliberately blind eye to those atrocities. They wanted, you know, they wanted basically to play Iran and Iraq off against each other. So they were arming Saddam Hussein. They were giving him all those weapons of mass destruction. There was an outfit called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum that was put together in 1983 or 4, whose whole purpose was to promote profitable opportunities for the likes of Philip Morris and Xerox and, you know, Boeing and all the rest of them. It was basically a kind of a corporate effort to further warm relations between the U.S. and Iraq. It had the blessings of, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and people like that. All of that had to disappear down the memory hole when it came time to demonize Saddam Hussein for his invasion of Kuwait. The fact is, you know, he was a bloodthirsty maniac. He had been one all along. It ultimately,
even when he was our friend, yeah.
he was our maniac,
right?
And in order for the propaganda to work in 1990, especially leading up to the Gulf War of 1991, it was crucial to sanitize the record, to just basically obliterate.
So the media helped by just not talking about it, and then by giving a very big play to events such as that pseudo-congressional hearing with Tom Lantos. Could you talk about that? Because that's
one of the most astonishing things that the propaganda forces did. This is Hillen Knowlton, was basically in charge of that whole
interview. They're a public relations firm?
Huge public relations firm that's been around for decades. Probably the biggest one in the world. They were hired by the Kuwaiti government in exile to, you know, basically do in 1990 what Britain and the U.S. did in 1915, which is to sell a big war to a population that really wasn't interested in it. And the campaign, the atrocity drive against Saddam Hussein, was eerily similar to the drive to demonize Germany after it had invaded Belgium. The rape of Belgium is what they called the earlier event, and the rape of Kuwait is what they called the later event. And the similarities are many, and they are quite striking. But basically, what Hillen Knowlton did, among other many other things, was to coach the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, have her testify in a congressional hearing about the notorious episode in which Iraqi troops took over a hospital in Kuwait City and emptied all these incubators that had newborn or premature babies in them. Her name was supposedly Nayira, and she testified very effectively, you know, tearfully, about having witnessed what these Iraqi troops did. And it was something like, I don't know, 32 incubators. They emptied them out on the floor. It was quite grotesque, quite gruesome. And everybody flipped out. You know, this was exactly the kind of thing that a propagandist dreams of, because it was so hideous and seemed to be so unimpeachable that people, you know, were hollering themselves hoarse to use this as a reason for us to go in there and smash the Iraqis as soon as possible. Well, it turned out, according to John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, who wrote a book about the build-up to the war in 1991, that this was not just some little Kuwaiti, you know, girl who happened to be working in a hospital. She had not been in a hospital. She wasn't your average Kuwaiti teenager. She was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador, I mean, the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was a member of the family that ran the country. This whole performance was just that. It was a piece of theater. What she said happened never happened. Human rights observers of various kinds, you know, who went back and actually did take a look at what Saddam Hussein did do in Kuwait, could find no evidence that any of these incubators were emptied in this way. But many more people to this day have heard that Saddam Hussein's troops did this than have heard that it didn't happen. And that's, you know, that's a sign that we're living in a kind of an unhealthy media culture where propaganda registers more.
And since the vote was very close in the Senate, it could have made the difference.
It could have made the difference.
The Iraq War, 2002 build up, 2003, the administration again used many important propaganda techniques. One I think is most effective is just the slogan, War on Terror.
Oh, yes, and of course the attack on the World Trade Center.
And this idea of constantly associating whoever you don't like with that attack.
Well, that's what, you know, that's what war propaganda is inevitably Manichaean in this way. It divides the universe into black and white, to good and evil.
So eventually, a majority of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein participated in the attack on the World Trade Center.
Well, yeah, for a while there, I think some 60-some percent of the American people believed there was a link between Saddam Hussein and the attack on 9/11. And to this day, I think the numbers are probably way too high. Now, if you compare the American public's understanding of what happened with the British public's understanding, there's all the difference in the world. Far fewer people in Britain thought that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11 for the very obvious reason that the British media did its job much more successfully than our media did. Our media was, and I believe remains, inordinately daunted by the Bush administration. It has always been far too shy about, you know, arguing with them or pointing out when they lie. So, you know, the press basically allowed itself to be used as a megaphone for the Bush administration.
And again, as in World War One, you frame the debate in terms you can't lose. Support the troops. I guess that means if you've opposed the policy, then you obviously don't like the troops.
Right. That's
if you
exactly
oppose
right.
the policy, you are in favor of terrorists.
That's right.
You also mentioned that Orwellian newspeak. You discussed that in the film. Was used frequently in the war. Things like, I guess, Operation Iraqi Freedom would be an example.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this, you know, the Bush administration has necessarily made us rethink Orwell, because all those tactics, those perverse tactics, calling things by the opposite of what they are. You know, war is peace, freedom is slavery. I mean, we used to think of that kind of thing as purely satiric, a kind of exaggeration of what went on in places like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. But you know, now it's obvious that this kind of thing can go on here and now in an ostensibly free country with an ostensibly free press. Now that, you know, it is routine for programs to be called by the opposite of their proper names, whether it's, you know, the Clean
Skies Act, for
Clean
example.
Skies Initiative, Healthy Forests Initiative.
Leave no child left behind.
No child left behind.
You can't win these arguments.
No, you can't. If you use their language, you've already succumbed to their agenda.
A front group which combined these phenomena was Swift Vote Veterans for Truth.
Swift Vote Veterans for Truth, yeah. That was another good one.
And again, he made, Bush Jr. made liberal use of front groups, the Iraqi National Congress, Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. Again,
yes.
As in World War One, have third parties support your position. But then he also did use the big lie when it came to weapons of mass destruction.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. It was obvious that they had no intention. They never intended not to invade Iraq. They basically flipped from rationale to rationale with a kind of dizzying speed that you know, a truly democratic media system would have pointed out. But here, you know, the mainstream, the so-called liberal media, was completely complicit in this. That's what this whole Scooter Libby thing basically demonstrated.
Well, the performance of the media in the current war does relate to the issue of a concentration of media ownership, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes, absolutely.
You quote, I believe it's Joseph Goebbels in the film Orwell Rolls in His Grave, where he said, "What you want in a media system is ostensible diversity that conceals an actual uniformity."
Yeah, that's a quote of Goebbels. Is another chillingly prescient quote. You know, the Nazis' propaganda was not highly dogmatic, explicitly anti-Semitic, party drivel that everybody was force-fed day after day. In fact, the media, the daily media diet that people took in under the Nazis was not all that different from ours. There's a lot of fluff, a lot of human interest, you know, a lot of detective magazines and crime stories.
So we get kind of a cartoon version of Nazi propaganda. It was actually more skillful than that.
Wait, say that again?
It was actually more subtle than when we were often led to believe.
Yes, it was quite subtle, and only a small minority of the films that Goebbels produced were outright Nazi propaganda films, because people shied away from that sort of thing.
We have a number of different networks. Why is it when you turn the dial, they're often covering the same story and giving you the same perspective?
Well, you know, the news serves a function absolutely antithetical to the function of propaganda. I mean, the two ought to be, ideally speaking, complete opposites.
The news,
now, the problem is that our news divisions now are simply one small part of a much larger machine, a much larger media cartel, which has got, what we're talking about, five or so parent companies, and all they really want to do is make as much money as possible. They're only thinking about the stock price. So they're thinking about short-term reports, you know. They have no sense of constitutional obligation.
So they behave the same, even though one might expect some competition amongst the networks. In fact, they're operating from the same game plan?
Well, they are. Plus, you know, they're in business with each other. They're not mere competitors. They have all kinds of strategic partnerships. They own stock in each other's parent firms. So it's really them and the government against the people. It's not a range of independent rivals, commercial rivals, trying to appeal to a mass audience and trying to, you know, woo us away.
They're more identifying with the government than with their obligation.
Yeah, well, this is exactly the opposite of what the framers had in mind when they wrote the First Amendment. But
back in 1977, Carl Bernstein wrote a famous article reporting that 400 American journalists had secretly carried out assignments for the CIA, for places like the New York Times, CBS, Time, Newsweek. That's indicative of how close the relationship is?
Well, that was the case decades ago. That was a consequence of the Cold War.
Is that sort of thing still going on, or is it more
subtle? I believe that it is. To say so sounds paranoid, but...
Well, you did have the phenomena in the last war with the Judith Miller of the New York Times being
an outlaw. Right, that's what I had in mind when I mentioned the Scooter Libby controversy.
And Robert Novak's reports discrediting Ambassador Joseph Wilson's reports by going to his wife.
What complicates all this is that there is no love lost between this White House and the CIA, so we're not talking about a monolithic system.
Yes.
And in fact, I think, you know, speaking of journalists on the CIA payroll, probably the most striking example of this kind of thing would be Bob Woodward, because as far too few people know, Bob Woodward's career after he graduated from college did not begin with his stint at the Washington Post or even at any newspaper at all. Before he became a journalist, Bob Woodward was with Navy Intelligence. He was actually the Joint Chiefs briefing officer to the White House, and his job involved going to the White House basement once a week to brief Al Haig, this comes as complete news to most people. It is in a few biographies of Woodward. It is a fact. But
it's important to know what's the real story behind the person.
Well, it certainly complicates the whole Watergate story, but beyond that, it sheds some light on Woodward's career. I mean, this guy is fabulously successful.
Maybe that's why he's better known than Carl Bernstein at this point.
Oh, far better known than Carl Bernstein. Woodward is, you know, gets access.
And that's what it's about, isn't it? That's the bludgeon, or the club that the government holds, is access or denial of access.
Well, to the common reporter, absolutely. But Woodward is in another universe. You know, Woodward is connected. So Woodward, you know, I think the most eloquent testimony to Woodward's fealty to the CIA would be his book State of Denial. Here he's written a trilogy, the first two volumes of which glorify Bush in his role as commander-in-chief. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, he writes a third volume after the Bush administration has trampled all over the CIA, scapegoated it, blamed it, you know, really given it a hard time. He writes a third book that actually he should have written in the first place, that exposes what a tissue of lies the war is based on and how badly it was being run. I find it very hard to believe that book was not, you know, basically part of an establishment attempt to get rid of Bush Cheney, whose policies are so extreme and so dangerous that they're going to hurt profits, you know.
Yes. So even their own constituency is having second thoughts about
them.
Yes,
I think as in the 60s, so now there's a rift within the establishment.
I'm afraid we have to come, we're getting near the end of our interview, but I wanted to close with your thoughts on this question. Is there a self-correcting mechanism in our system that can restore power to the people?
A self-correcting mechanism for what?
That can restore, in the media, some way that people can gain more control over their media.
Well, there's not a self-correcting mechanism. What we need is to return to the principles of the First Amendment. The press that the framers had in mind when they drafted the First Amendment bore no relation to the media industry we have today. The idea that you know, highly capitalized commercial firms would be providing people with news, the likes of General Electric and Disney would be in charge of the media, this would have appalled and mystified the framers. Back in their day, the press was basically any citizen who could afford to set up a printing press and start publishing a newspaper. The blogosphere of today is far closer to the press of the 18th century than the so-called media. So the only way that we're going to rectify the situation and to democratize the press in this country again is through radical media reform. We have got to break down these cartels. We've got to re-regulate the broadcast media. You know, we have a tremendous amount of work to do to reverse the damage that's been done to the press, first by Reagan and then by Clinton. It was they who did the most to corporatize the media and enable this nonstop consolidation. And, if, you know, there's no self-correcting mechanism aside from the willingness and commitment of the people to insist on change, because it's only when the government fears its people that it will listen to them.
Thank you very much, Professor Miller.
All right. Mm-hmm.
everyone you know cooks electrically or will electrically.
Take one. The Baltimore Gas and Electric Company. Gas. Electricity. All the energy you want. All the service you need.
I had a swamp in my throat that length.
Yeah. Take two. Take one. The Baltimore Gas and Electric Company. Gas. Electricity. All the energy you want. All the service you need.
Electricity. All
want. All the service you need.
Things happen.